This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Welcome to John Richardson and the Future Nauts, the Book of Revelations. And I'll tell you what, suck on this. I know what episode it is and what we're talking about. It's episode 8 and it's our end of year review. I know who I am. I'm John Richardson. I know who you are. You're Mark Stevenson. And the other fella, that's Ed Gillespie.
Yeah?
Hey!
You know what? It's only taken 2 Christmases for you to get our names right.
Yeah. Episode 32.
Yeah, well done.
Picked a hell of a time to get slick. So we're here to discuss 2021 and the riot it's been. So let's start with an email from a listener. Because what I asked the other week, what do you do when you listen to this show? And we've had an email from Jen in Liverpool. And since it's the end of year, I'm going to bring the accents back. So here's Jen in Liverpool, who says... And all they ask is to let you know what we do when we're listening to the podcast. Ricky Tomlinson. I thought I'd let you know what I no longer do while listening in the hope that you'll introduce a health warning. Anyways, I listen while I'm exercising in the morning. During season 1, my exercise consisted of gymnastics, which often involved handstand work. Not knowing quite what to expect from the podcast, I thought nothing of being in an inverted position that required every muscle to be tense while my head hovered inches above a wooden floor. Now, I'm sure you'll have worked this out, but unexpected bouts of laughter aren't conducive to keeping tension throughout your body. I had a few near misses in the early episodes, especially when John attempted the Scandinavian accent. I hope you're enjoying this one, Jen. You'll crack your head open. Then the testacuzzi happened. Severe bruising and a TBI later, I decided to retire from gymnastic work while listening to the Future Nauts. Nice one on the pod. It's a belter. It's a shame she was enjoying the podcast. It's a shame she can't listen anymore. I think we've become less popular in Liverpool than the Sun in the last 12 minutes.
Is this where we've got to in 2021, though, that you need to have a health warning on your podcast, like, do not listen to this whilst in an inverted position with every skeletal muscle in your body in tension?
Trying to turn the bloody system upside down, right, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. Than that? Yeah, so while we're hemorrhaging listeners, let's get rid of Deborah from Melbourne. She says, greetings all. Always very much enjoying your podcast and the concise and very informative chat with Jane Davidson. Simon Galah. However, the whole thing was spoiled by the mention of Scott Morrison and his coal crap. My heckles rose and I may have dropped an F-bomb. That man who sat in Parliament with a lamp of Fisk in his lap telling Parliament clean coal is the way of the future, and his cohorts laughed and agreed. You can Google this. The man has no concept of what's going on in our country. He did not believe in climate change and only goes to these overseas summits so he can say he's mates with whoever. The man is a knob. So a correction there for Deborah. I don't remember mentioning Scott Morrison. We didn't say he was a good guy, did we?
No,
definitely
Jane,
didn't.
Jane was referring to his ridiculousness in kind of, you know, promoting coal while there's wildfires across, you know, huge swathes of the country, you know, destroying citizens' livelihoods and indeed killing them. So, you know.
Yeah, he literally goaded his own political opposition across the floor of the parliament by waving a piece of coal around and saying, this is coal, don't be afraid. you know. And then shortly afterwards, you know, the half the country's on fire, and it's like, actually, we probably should be a little bit afraid, you know,
yes,
just on a simply pragmatic basis.
Yeah, it would have been a braver thing to turn up with a piece of nuclear metal in your pocket, I suppose, and say this is the alternative and hold up some rapidly degrading nuclear matter. Coal's a sort of, in that sense, a safer option, but not for the planet. But that speaks to where the emails are at, and we put out for, you know, questions and things like that. What we got a lot of, people saying very nice things about the podcast, which is lovely, but in the context of the fact that we take it as read, that everything is horrific, the news is awful, and those that are of the disposition that they want to try and help feel more upset than ever. So the podcast is a sort of ray of hope in a broken world. Is that how you both feel about things at the moment? Has your 2021 been one of optimism? Do you feel better than you did this time last year, or worse?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think it is kind of like the regular grist. When you've been working in this stuff as long as we have, you know, I think it's half my life now, that I think you have to sort of try and take it the rough with the smooth. And I'm not sure I'm more optimistic than this time last year, but there are weak signals from the future, as some futurists like to say. And I think you have to be a bit stoic, particularly when we're in the kind of the pandemic furore that we're still embedded in, that I think perhaps last year there were some few sort of shafts of light with potential vaccines coming in and everything, and I think we realize it's not that simple now. So I think for me, on balance, it's like, you know, you just got to keep on keeping on.
It's very much a Groundhog Day situation.
Yeah,
I feel, you know, oh yeah, oh no, oh yeah, oh no, oh yeah, oh no. It's a bit like, so I think, I mean, it's just like, you know, for us, it's kind of like, it's just the job, is that you resolutely maintain some kind of pragmatic optimism.
How about you, John? How are you feeling after another year?
Well, I mean, I would echo what you've said. I've got to a point where I feel more involved than that. So last year, obviously, we'd started the podcast, but I wouldn't say outside of the podcast I was as involved. This would be the first year that I've done some climate work outside of this podcast. I've had a massive argument with my wife about whether we can fly on holiday anymore. So mm-hmm. I've brought it very much to home. And work-wise, I've turned down a lot of work. I'm not necessarily, I would have definitely done it in the past, but for example, recently I got offered the best thing I've ever been offered, which is traveling around South America talking about football, and just couldn't do it. And knew instantly when the email came in that there's no way I can take that job, but then had an instant fury that someone's going to take it, and I'm going to watch that program in a year or two whenever it comes out, and I'm going to see a comic that took the thing that I could have had, and it's the knowledge that they probably won't get any criticism for it.
But you could have taken it, John.
I don't think I could, not after the argument with my wife. You know, if we're not allowed to fly on holiday, I can't go to meet, you know,
but you, yeah,
footballers.
But, you know, I'm building a carbon removals company, so you could have done it, and I could have got you, you know, all your carbon removed, and you could have done it and not had the argument with your wife.
This is the Mark Stevenson, get out of climate change jail free.
Well, that will, I mean, that will be of genuine appeal to listeners, carbon removal. Is that something you want to talk about now? Is that something we're going to talk about in the future on the podcast?
We are. We're going to have Dr. Gabriel Walker on, and we're going to talk about it in detail. I mean, it's not possible now, but we will, you know, all the science says we have to build the industry, whether we like it or not. It is possible to do. It's expensive and it's complicated, and there's a lot of snake all about, but we're going to talk about that in depth in the new year.
Yeah, okay. So I couldn't have taken the South American gig, really. But what I can do is make a sort of carbon neutral British version where I travel to Matlock and meet the players of Matlock Town,
yeah,
which I'm sure will be as exciting as filming in Argentina and
especially
Peru.
If you speak to them only in Spanish.
Absolutely. Why not? Do you have specific things, because we do try and focus on the positive, so let's talk about the, are there specific things you would look back on, accepting that answer that, you know, it's wins and losses and the fight remains? Let's list some things that you can look back on 2021 and start optimistically and categorically saying these are good things that have happened this year.
I mean, for me, there's a bunch of climate stuff which has been like genuine milestones where you're going, and things which have, you know, actually pleasantly surprised me. So, you know, back in May, the International Energy Agency, which is like, you know, the industry body of the energy world, which has always been used as a bit of a fig leaf covering the immodesty of some of the fossil fuel giants, you know, and they basically published their new net zero pathway, which essentially said there was no need for any new oil and gas exploration, no new oil and gas fields required, and no new coal mines in order to meet the net zero energy pathway through to 2050. And that was huge, because that was like a sort of, you know, it was a shot across the bows of the whole industry, because this is their industry body saying, you know, all of your new oil and gas that you're talking about, like Cambo Field up off Shetland that we've been debating in the UK, is not necessary. Actually, we can find a way through this by filling the gap and filling the shortfall with renewables. So that was massive. And then that was sort of directly connected into a couple of other things where just immediately after that, the Danish environment minister then argued that basically they're going to put a moratorium on new oil and gas exploration in Danish waters. And Denmark is the biggest exporter of oil and gas in the EU because Norway's just outside it. So that was huge. And then that was closely followed up by the Shell ruling in the Netherlands, the Dutch High Court, in a citizens case brought by 17,000 Dutch citizens, which required them to cut their carbon emissions by 45%. By 2030. And the interesting thing about that is that, A, it's a massive existential challenge to Shell, with basically saying that the highest court in the Netherlands arguing that they have got to genuinely cut their emissions significantly harder and faster than they were planning on doing. But what it really proved was actually this idea of tort law, T-O-R-T. And tort law is essentially knowingly inflicting harm on others, which is actually quite a basic principle of general public law. And you know, for our friends at places like Client Earth, this is huge, because if that gets passed through as case law, and there are already 1,800 climate lawsuits pending around the world, which could all be influenced by this tort law precedent, then that's absolutely massive. And, you know, Mark and I have both sort of, I think, intimated that we think, you know, these legal actions on climate are going to accelerate and intensify, and there are going to be a lot more of them. And I think this is starting to open the floodgates. So I think legally on climate, we're starting to get into a really interesting position where we might actually have some genuine muscle of the full force of the law starting to be brought to bear on some of the shifty gerrymandering of some of the biggest emitters on the planet.
Yeah. And I think for me, the big thing is, like, culturally now, you know, COP26 was, you know, a bit of a mixed bag. But there's no way you can deny now that pretty much every nation, in fact, is having to orientate itself around that story. It's like, what are you doing about climate? Even if they're trying to fudge it, it's no longer like, oh, we can ignore it. It's like everybody has to react to it. So we've got this direction of travel. It's too late. But, the whole playing field has kind of changed over the last 2 years, where, you know, it used to be, it'd be impossible to say things like, you know, your company has to have a net zero strategy. At COP26, every UK company above a certain size is being told by Rishi Sunak they have to publish a net zero strategy. You know, so everybody's now orientating themselves against that story. It's kind of the foundational story of our times. It's 30 years too late, but that's, you know, a huge opportunity. And one quote that I go back to a lot when it comes to change that I always find very hopeful is Bill Gates, who actually said, we always overestimate what we'll do in 2 years and we completely underestimate what we'll do in 10. And I think it'd be very interesting in 10 years' time to see where we are on this kind of journey towards renewables and carbon removal and, you know, biodiversity renewal. I think it'll be hopefully quite surprising. I mean, that's what keeps the fuel in my tank. Who knows? But that's the rest of my career.
I mean, presumably. I mean, the sort of messaging at the moment is that we'll know far sooner than 10 years.
Well, yeah. That's the downside of all of that. You know, I'm going to say those are the sort of stirrings of some dark, guarded optimism. I use the word optimism tentatively.
I think you balanced it out with the words dark and guarded. I think the gist came across.
But I think that's the other thing. You know, we're already seeing not that climate collapse, but, you know, the heat dome in Canada, you know, another season of crazy wildfires, the catastrophic floods in Germany, you know, the most recently, the kind of insanely intense tornadoes in America, you know, outside of tornado season. So I think you're also simultaneously, whilst we're seeing these little green shoots of a shift and a change, we're also seeing things get worse.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very interesting time to be alive.
That oddly sounded more sinister than the dark guarded optimism. You've really gone Bond villain this evening, Mark. I like it. It's a very interesting time to be alive,
Mr. Bond.
But no, it is a thing. I mean, I definitely feel that at the moment. One of the things I've had to learn this year is to almost become resigned to the fact that it's never going to be sorted in my lifetime, and I'm going to have to learn to live to be happy in a very uncertain world. And that's quite a big challenge.
Well, we should come on to personal happiness, because do you know what it made me think of when you were talking? I just read the statement of Laura Koonsberg, who's retiring as the BBC chief political editor. And she said in her statement, you know, what a wonderful time to have had this job. And that is very much, I don't imagine she's enjoyed all of it. And, you know, she's trended on Twitter more than most because we live in a very angry time. But her view is, well, what a time to have this job. And I guess the two of you have to have something of an element of that to protect your own mental well-being, is to say, well, if this is the fight you want, then now's the time to have it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, and that's connected into, you know, this other idea, which I think would be one of my highlights, which is the outspokenness, you know, of the debate now. You know, I wrote this piece earlier this year about breaking a murta, you know, this sort of Italian code of silence for so many people who work professionally in that sort of sustainability world, because arguing that in many ways, you know, people have become complicit with, you know, the system effectively defending itself or slowing down the pace of change to one with which it is comfortable, as opposed to having these genuine breakthrough transformative type of moments. And I think there's something really powerful that started to happen there, where people realizing, you know, am I just propping up the status quo in some way and offering it, you know, some kind of fig leafing to protect it? Or am I genuinely involved in the radical change that we need? And I think some of that soul searching is now becoming more public too.
So on the personal then, talking about, you know, maintaining positivity, are there any personal things? I would usually ask a trivial question here, but it is a nice time to look back on your year personally and ask if there's anything that's made you feel happy.
I moved house. Relocating to Norfolk has been the best thing I've done in a long time. Recording present podcast with you exceptional gentlemen to one side, it's like it's been a superb thing for me to just get out of Dodge and get back into damp and muddy nature. So it's transformed my life.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Ed moving away from me it's been absolutely fantastic for all of us, really. We all feel a lot happier in London.
I haven't moved quite far enough away from Mark to prevent him visiting, but you know it's like six of one, half a dozen of the other.
So looking forward then to the coming year, and a question from Felicity, who again opens her email with some very nice things about the podcast and says that thing that a lot of people have said about how difficult the last few years have been and how important it's been to have some sort of inspirational stuff to listen to, but inspirational stuff that is based in fact. And she goes on to say, it's led me to buy one of Mark's books and listen to Ed's Great Humbling podcast. So cha-ching on that.
Because we make so much money out of both of those.
I mean, we actually make not a single penny on The Great Humbling. So, you know, that is a gift of content.
And do you know what? Do you know what happened to me this on the book? I got a royalty statement from my publisher this year saying, "Oh, we've sold the rights to your last book in China, and that means you've cleared your advance. So you're actually going to earn some royalties." I was like, "Great, fantastic! Finally, I don't know, it's only like 6 years. I might start earning some money off the book." Went and bought a bottle of champagne, and then they emailed and said, "Oh, that was a mistake. Can you send us the money back?"
It's not quite as cruel as my publisher, who said, I asked him how sales were going, and he said, "Well, put it this way, we might have to start charging you for storage." It's like, wow. Oh. I was going to say, so I'm actually paying you to store my unsold books. That's amazing.
I tell you what, we've had some suggestions for topics that we could talk about. Josh wants us to talk about architecture and the building trade. We've had that one a little bit in the past, separate to sort of housing, which we've done.
Well, for Josh's entertainment later in this series, we'll be having the wonderful Michael Paulin, who is kind of an eco-architect, systems thinker, and also the founder of Architects Declare, which is all about the architects responding to climate emergency. So he should look forward to that episode.
Oh, well, there you go. We've had a fascinating email from Phil on the future of free will, who believes that there is no such thing as free will. Every act we do is a result of our upbringing. Therefore, the system is responsible for all crime and therefore all vengeance as well. It's a fascinating email, something we may discuss. But if you want to do an episode on the future of publishing, because I'll tell you what, that is that's a horrible business to be in.
Ooh.
And the tone of your response there, Ed, is exactly. It's become a very, do you know what I hate now? The very last thing that matters to anyone selling a book is the content of the book. It's all about doing something wacky to get yourself trending on Twitter so that you can then say, I've got a book out. Drives me absolutely insane.
If you look at publishers now, they are literally almost not interested in the content of the book. That's not true of all of them, I have to say. There are some brilliant editors out there and there are some great publishers. But really, it's like, what's the product? How much of it can we shift? And thing is, I was talking to Robin Ince about this because we share a literary agent, and it takes him ages to write books. He says, because, you know, who needs another book? Unless I can come up with a book that hasn't been written and I think is important, there's no point in doing it. But, you know, publishers, they're part of a sausage machine. They have to just keep all these books going out there. And it's kind of like, well, there used to be this idea that the book was this incredible font of gorgeousness and exploration and knowledge and whatever, and now it's just another fucking commercial item. So fuck you, publishers, for totally hollowing out your own industry. And I say this just as I'm trying to get a new book deal.
is this your pitch for book three? Publishing world.
I was so nervous when you started that speech because I do this thing a lot. You know, when you're at a party or you're with people and you start slagging someone off and you think, oh, everyone's going to get in on this. And then someone say, I actually quite like them. I think they're really nice. And when you started, I thought, oh no, he's going to talk about all the good things the publishing world does. So speaking as a turd, let me say how grateful I am for you ending that. Fuck you, publishers. Anyway, back to Felicity. She says, what struck me from discovering the podcast in October is the focus on your early episodes on life after the pandemic. Although we are not yet in the post-pandemic world, it does seem there have been pockets of normality, she puts that in inverted commas, returning over the last 6 months. And she basically asks, are we on the sort of slow train to getting back to exactly the way we used to be? She says, I may be being overly negative. I'm also aware I'm only thinking of things at a very micro level. But if we're going to change, we all need to act as individuals. What is your perception of this and the longer term effect the pandemic has had on attitudes and behaviours, if any?
Well, that's a lovely small question. Thanks, Felicity. And very easy to answer. I think
would have been a lovely book if you hadn't just pissed off every publisher in the country.
I think that it's very easy to be cynical. And what I'm hearing in that email is like, do you think other people have changed? And actually the answer to that question is it doesn't really matter. Have you?
Oh, lovely. Very nice. Mm.
I think the noisier people haven't changed as much as we might like, but perhaps the quieter folk have and are, which might be an extension of what Mark's saying there. I think the biggest thing through all of this, and I think something we get from a lot of listeners in their feedback, is, you know, this desire to keep learning and to keep open-minded and to accept challenge and understand that the way things are shifting and changing, perhaps in a slightly more slow and profound way rather than the usual media wind chop and surface waves. I was reflecting on this type of topic actually in advance of tonight, and I came up with a great quote from Robert Frost, who said, education is the ability to listen to almost anything without losing your temper or self-confidence, which probably applies to most of our listeners because, you know, you have to be able to listen to completely contrasting and challenging points of view, you know, without losing the plot. And I think we're only just starting to do that in the kind of tail end of the pandemic. And we now accept the fact that learning is a lifelong process, you know, and it's all about keeping abreast of change. And the most pressing task, as Peter Drucker said, is to teach people how to learn. And so if we are going to avoid just going back to normal and applying the lessons and the insights of the pandemic, then we have to keep open-minded and keep learning.
So what are your hopes for the next year then, if you could cherry pick some things that you hope we will perhaps do as individuals or systemically? What would you love to be discussing when we do our review of 2022?
Well, there's obviously the Future Nauts Live Tour,
of course. Right around South America and Australia.
I would almost resist that question, because I think what you learn from doing this job is, like, hoping for things is problematic. It's just like, what's the job to do? What needs to be done right now? What's the maximum effect I can make here? And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. I'll try again. So I think my biggest hope is that we are still all doing this podcast next year and still talking, and we still have a listenership. And that, for me, will be enough.
I think Mark's right. I mean, I think, you know, my hope would be it's not enough just to do good things anymore. You know, actually, one of my hopes for the coming year and beyond is that we've got to stop doing the bad things. You know, we can't just have all these, like, nice to haves, like renewable energy and all the other things that are happening on the side. They've actually got to stop the bad shit happening at the same time, because otherwise it's just additionality. And it doesn't matter whether that's a kind of socially and environmentally produced trainer or the global energy system. You know, we've got to stop doing the bad stuff. And I think on a slightly more sort of prosaic UK level, I think, you know, we have to stop things like the policing bill, you know, which is genuine creeping authoritarianism from a government which is riding roughshod over our civil rights and our right to non-violent democratic protest. I think that's absolutely fundamental. I mean, you know, we could be criminalized for going out and protesting against the leaders who are leading us into all sorts of dubious territory. So I think, you know, we have to get off our asses, and that's a call out to everyone out there to write to their MP, to lobby the House of Lords to do something about that. And I think on a more positive note, I think that there's something really interesting stirring in some of the themes we've touched on in the problems with social media and technology. I think we might have mentioned, like, the Ecosia search engine when we were talking about one of the topics earlier in the series. But, you know, they give 80% of their profits to charity, and they've planted 140 million trees off the back of people using Ecosia instead of Google. And, you know, Tim Berners-Lee's solid web protocol, which uses what he calls pods, which is personal online data stores. So it basically puts the control of your data back into your hands, which is something really powerful in terms of web disruption, because it enables us to separate all the applications and the platforms from the data, which is where all the money and power and insidious impacts are being made at the moment. And it touches on the idea of trust, that we put trust back into people's hands and trust with the platform, but it also gives us interoperability, so we could actually swap platforms whilst keeping hold of our own data, rather than being hogtied to a particular platform because that's where you've got all of your history and connection to. And I think that's extraordinary. And then I came across a third one today, which was it's called Supernova, which is a British social media platform, which some people are already describing as the Instagram killer. And it's giving 60% of its profits to charity. It's not driven by the sort of narcissistic likes that other platforms are. Basically, when people click an approval on your particular post, that generates revenue for your favorite charity or your favorite good cause. They're going for 1% of the global social media advertising budget. So they're trying to get 1% of advertising spend online. And they reckon if they do that, that will generate £600 million a year for the good causes that they've got on board. Now, if Facebook did that, that would be 51 billion quid.
Yeah, well, and there's another network called We Are 8, which is starting up next year, which is has worked out a way to give you the money for watching an ad rather than give it to Facebook. And then part of that also goes to good causes. So I think there's going to be a lot of disruption in that social media space next year, actually making it social again rather than extractive. I mean, basically, when you look at Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they are extractive industries. They should be viewed very much in the same way that oil and gas are. So it kind of, like, bypasses that whole $90 billion funnel of shit into, you know, Zuckerberg's pocket to basically carry on disrupting us into, you know, tribal narcissism. You know, fuck that. You know, so I think there's going to be a massive, massive reinvention of social media in the next 5 years. And thank God. Because, you know, essentially, if you, a historian will look at Facebook and kind of think that was like the dark satanic mills of the early internet.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's discuss the positives of social media, which are that people can reach out to the show and get in touch and they can own up to some of the awful things they've done, which brings us nicely on to ending the show in the confessional booth. So don your, what do you wear for these? Some sort of monk's outfit? Or... So we've had a confession come in. Let's call this person Mr. Bush. And this person is known to me.
How are they known to you?
I'm not going to go into detail until I've read the confession, and then I may choose not to be associated with that person. He says, "Hello, team." He's a language teacher. For Christmas one year, at the end of the usual term of drilling irregular verbs and all that guff, I asked my head teacher to buy me a ventriloquist dummy. I said I would use it in class to model dialogues, counsel children who may be too scared to speak to adults, and maybe make a few YouTube videos. The head surprisingly agreed, and it was done. The real reason I wanted the dummy was that I had been struggling to cope in class with the extra workload occasioned by the presence of two students and a very judgmental and extremely irritating teaching assistant who seemed to expect me to teach in an orthodox way. Plans, targets, resources, etc. I will say this is a teacher who used to belt a football around in the exam hall, and while I was doing my GCSE French, leant over my shoulder, tutted and sighed, and then walked away. So, when you say unorthodox, he really means it. As soon as Hugo arrived in class for the next session, he took over affairs completely, and I was largely uninvolved in proceedings. I personally obviously refused to engage in lessons, absolving all responsibility, I suppose, and the teaching assistant and her charges went to study German instead of French. Best wishes, Mr. Bush and Hugo. I mean, I didn't know that story. What do you make of a teacher using a ventriloquist puppy to avoid having to teach students who are, in his words, too much work?
A ventriloquist puppy or a ventriloquist dummy?
Did I say puppy?
A puppy. I don't know. It wouldn't be the first ventriloquist to blame his puppet for his own poor behaviour. I always remember when, was it Rod Hull, an emu, was on Parkinson with Billy Connolly. And you know, Rod Hull with Amy sort of went to lunge at Billy Connolly, and Billy Connolly just looked at him and went, and goes, "If that bird comes anywhere near me, I'll break its neck and your arm."
I've just finished his book this week.
It's brilliant.
Absolutely sensational.
I know, Amy is such a good writer.
Very nice.
I mean, the confession is it's quite dark.
It's a man who I think has left the teaching profession and considers himself beyond reproach. That's what I read into that. Mm-hmm. The act of a man coming to terms with what he's done and finding it quite funny.
Firstly, I think it's great that he's got it off his chest, that he's finally been able to unload that. I mean, that whole point of confessions is catharsis, after all. But equally, I think if you're the victim of disproportionate anality from a by-the-book teaching assistant, where we all know that creativity, compassion and critical thinking are the key aspects we want to see in education, which aren't necessarily always predicated on plans and targets and resources. So, I sort of empathise.
This is the toughest confession we've had because the others have been redeemable, but I'm not sure this one is.
Yes.
You can't undo that, can you? You can't undo the disengagement with those difficult people.
Perhaps they go on to excel in German in a way that they never would have in French and become chancellor, something like that.
I've had a confession in from some of my contacts at the Cabinet Office. Can I read it to you?
Have you really?
Yeah. It says, for a long time as a small boy, imagined that I wanted to be in charge of the world. I've now become Prime Minister and have discovered that I am really shit at it. However, I'm stuck here. And I don't know what to do. I've done some really bad things, and I slightly hate myself. What should I do?
Resign.
So we've discussed that it was a mixed bag last year. You skillfully, well, you didn't skillfully dodge my question about what you hope for next year. You told me you weren't going to answer it because it was horseshit, and I appreciate that honesty from you, Mark. But just in terms of our podcast then, could we be a little specific about things that will be coming?
Yeah, so we've already touched on the future of drawdown and carbon emissions being sucked out of the atmosphere, which we'll do with Dr. Gabriel Walker. We've got the future of the citizen with our mutual friend John Alexander, who's got a new book coming out called The Citizen Shift. And then we've got the future of future visions, how we think about the future, and then maybe even the future of aliens, just to get us chewing on some of that UFO and Fermi paradox type of stuff. So plenty of good grist to come to your ears in January and February.
Yes.
Thank you for your company. Thank you, as always, to our producer, Michael, who remains silent but is lurking. He's the reason that you continue to listen to this podcast, because he takes out a lot of what we say that is frankly unbroadcastable. I mean, if you knew the truth about the three of us, it's a stunning edit job. Sometimes I listen back to it and I think he's taken individual words and structured entire conversations. I remember having a 45-minute conversation about how you get shit out of a quilt. Yeah. And yet Michael has put that into a show somehow where it sounds like we're talking about the future of the climate. Yeah. Absolutely stunning work.
He is the cassette boy of podcast editing.
I'm shitting frying pans. But I think we would all say a thank you as well to everyone who's listening, because as has been mentioned, it's not a for-profit podcast and it exists only because the emails we get they're an inspiration, and they're why the podcast continues, because people are kind enough to say, we've had someone email to say that they've set up a business off the back of this podcast. People have changed careers, which is a pressure I'm not quite comfortable with, but broadly people say they enjoy the optimism, they enjoy the humor, and they enjoy having some of their thoughts on certain topics challenged. And that is reason alone for this podcast to exist. It's entirely the work of Mark and Ed, because all I do is sit and drink wine and pretend I'm following the conversation. So congratulations to the two of you, and thank you to everyone who's taken the time to reach out and get in touch with us. And if you would like to, here's how you can do it. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. That's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson, John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @Frucool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour. Before we go, John, you always do this thing.
This thing. It's a podcast, mate. Call it what it is.
You do this thing where you always say that really it's me and Ed that make the show, and you're always very generous about it, and you're always very, oh, I'm just the kind of idiot who asks the questions. But really, that's not true. You are so smart, and you are so thoughtful, and the way you question people, particularly with the interviewees this season, has been pretty extraordinary. And if I could give you any advice for the new year, it would be to stop self-effacing your own brilliance.
Well, I make you this promise then, because you should gratefully receive any gift, and I'm very grateful for what you said. And let me tell you now that the first episode next year, I am going to be fucking unbearable. I'm going to be the smuggest piece of shit you have ever encountered on any podcast.
Well, that's a New Year's resolution that you could perhaps live up to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I shall say, welcome to John Richardson and then I'll mumble. And I'll probably get your names wrong. What do you think of that? That's never happened before.
Plus ça change, Mr. Bush.
We will be with you throughout 2022, so long as you'll have us. Thank you, everyone. Look after each other.